Our recording. So welcome everybody. We're going to have an open dialogue and discussion about ancestral healing for about an hour, and questions of any sort are welcome. And I want to name up front that I'm trying to get the word out about, one, the book that I've written, Ancestral Medicine, Rituals for Personal and Family Healing, and also the new online course, which I'm very excited about, which the link for it is on my site, ancestralmedicine.org/online-course, and it's there if you go to the site. And it's a very thorough course that encapsulates the material in the heart of the book and what I have been doing for the last 12, 13 years with in-person trainings. And if you're drawn to this work, it's a self-paced, thorough course with lots of readings, lots of opportunity for interaction with other learners, and also scholarship spaces as needed for folks of Indigenous, African, also LGBTQ background. So I want to keep the work accessible. So I'm going to make that plug up front and then turn to your questions. So thanks everybody for tuning in. And one of the early questions that came through is about someone whose mother has passed in the last decade and was not accepting of them, including around the sexual orientation, and a desire to have reconnection with her as an ancestor, but also, I'm extrapolating here, feeling conflicted about intentionally engaging when there was such a hurt and lack of acceptance during life. And so it's a great question, and there are a lot of situations that are similar to that. And so a few things. One, the ask, at least at first, or the invitation with ancestral repair work, at least as I hold it, is not about relating with her as an individual. It's about saying your mother's 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 lineage, your mother's father's 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 lineage, that your mother is the convergence point of 2, 4, 6, 8, but let's say at least 2, that's how I hold it, 2 lineages on each side, lineages of ancestors before her that each carry their own distinct and different kinds of blessings and challenges that are worth understanding and reclaiming. And so the intent is to come into relationship with lineages rather than individuals. The individual who happens to be situated in that lineage is almost, is eclipsed, if you will, by the energy of lineage. And so the good thing about that is it makes one's parents or grandparents or even recent generations right properly sized, so they're not obscuring or preventing us from having a renewed and more complete relationship with a bigger, much bigger energy of lineage before them. So their ancient grandmothers, way like pre-Christian, pre-colonialism, all that before your mother's life. And so that's one way around it. What happens in the process is once you come into the relationship with those ancient ones and start to invite their healing to be established forward, forward, forward along the line, eventually you arrive at the point where your mother's mother and all the grandmothers before her on back through time are deeply well in spirit. Only at that point would you then invite them to receive your mother into their collective well energy. And only when she's been received into that collective well energy would it then make any real sense to interact with her. Because in a sense, as at least as I hold it, she's not a fully seated ancestor until she's settled with the energy of lineage before her. And so that stage of the work allows for a whole different kind of relationship to occur. It allows for grieving of past disconnections because she in spirit is able to show up for the repair as well. So it's not just grieving what didn't happen. It's grieving plus, whoa, sorry, I was a judgmental shit to you or whatever, which tends to make the grieving move along quicker. And the dead who during life have strong biases about identity, sexual orientation, religion, whatever it is, tend to soften once they become relatively well in spirit. And they tend, in addition to that, once they're seated with the older healed ancestors, to be, I want to use the word bullied in a good way, by the older, wiser dead, to not be judgy shits toward the living anymore. And so in addition to that, we can contact, like on the topic specifically of sexual orientation, it's my view that at any given, along any given lineage of anyone on the call, if you track back far enough in time, you're going to encounter ancestors who lived in a culture that was less judgy about such things. Not even less judgy, but would recognize that non-heterosexual people, not gender-conforming people, etc., come with unique gifts for the community that are celebrated. And so you can ask the older lineages on your mom's mom's line to help you to understand more deeply how your sexual orientation is an inherited ancestral gift, which often can be a bit of a reframe when it's been a source of othering from living family. So I hope that responds some. It's a good question. Thanks. Great. Thanks for the thumbs up. Yay. Others, I see a question from Tamira. I'm going to respond to that. And I'm going to invite the other 30 people on a call to start typing in some questions if you got them. Tamir is asking, can I recommend any Irish ritual-like books? Halloween's coming up, or Samhain would like to have a better understanding of the holiday's roots. Oh, there are such books, and I'm not sure what they are. That's my truth on that. I know if you just look up Samhain, it looks like S-A-M-H-A-I-N, and follow the wiki links, you're likely to get relatively accurate historical information. I know that pagans, bless their super pagan, earthy, dirt worshiping heart, I share that, tend to be notoriously bad about scholarship. And so be discerning about what you read about the older origins, but also know that Samhain, or what has become Halloween, definitely does have ancient Celtic roots. So take a little bit of a discerning scholarly approach to the reading. And if anyone on the call has a really reliable book, not just revisionist fantasy, but actually historically informed goodness, feel free to send that and I could share it with the group. So I wish I had a better answer on that one, Tamira. And are there Ifa holidays that celebrate the ancestors and the dead? So Ifa, or for folks who aren't familiar, traditional Yoruba religion from Southwest Nigeria, Benin, Togo. For sure. Yes, there are ancestor festivals, Egungun festivals, and different, and the dates of those vary. I think they're often during our summer, which is a little bit cooler time of year there. But I think that varies as well. So often there are annual festivals where the masquerades come out. Otherwise, I think the graves, the dead are fed ritually at the graves, I think on anniversaries of death, and people may appeal to their ancestors at any time, which includes when nudged to do that through divination, when visited in a dream, or when there's just a desire to go to them. So yeah, like that. I think it's driven partly by annual renewal ceremonies and also by a ritual need in the moment. So great. Thank you, Tamira. There's just one other question so far, so I'm just going to start winging it if nobody has any questions about anything. Another question is, someone's asking, how did this work come to me? Oh, geez, it's kind of a whole story. But briefly, in high school, I got cracked open to the reality of other spirits, powers, things like that, partly just through eating strong psychoactive things. And that left me scrambling for a framework. And so I got one through contemporary like shamanist revival practices, paganism. And then my first teachers in pagan practice, Becky and Crow with the Church of Earth Healing, did something really good for me by introducing me to just a day of ancestor-focused ritual, which I write about in the book. And it included connecting with my father's father in spirit who had shot himself, and the healing that the older ancestors along that line brought forward for him was really impactful for me. It was a psychologically impactful. It was ritually impactful. It was something that I would spend years processing the implications of. So it set me on a path of learning about my own specific family history, which I had strongly devalued as someone of German, English, Irish colonizer, settler ancestry, and seeing the sacred also in my own lineages, and then doing years of training as a therapist and doctor of psychology, and just running the implications of ancestor work as a work with blood ancestors as a intersection point for calling to ritual. And increasingly, what's kept me in it so long as a focus is seeing the implications for cultural healing. I live in the United States. I'm American. Like, for all the ugliness and complexity of that, we're a mixed, contentious, complicated bunch founded on a history of double genocide toward Native peoples and African ancestor peoples. And so many people are multicultural, multiracial. And so ancestor work brings all that completely to the foreground. And so it's continued to stay alive and relevant for me in that way. So I'll say just that much for now. It's a good question. There's actually some questions coming in.
Good.
Let me scroll up and see what's happening. Someone's asking about using stones to represent ancestors. No, it's great. There's a section in the book in chapter 6 about making an ongan, which is a Mongolian, Buryat Mongol style of making like a spirit house for the ancestors. And people do an Andean tradition will use a mesa, or they'll use stones for the ancestors. I don't know, the Jewish ancestor reverence is exactly representing the ancestors in stones, but stones are used as prayer, memorial, markers at graves. No, it's actually very conventional to use a stone to honor them. So it doesn't even make you weird. Sorry. What you could do if you want to be especially animistic about it is ask the stone if it actually wants to be a spirit house for your dead people. So be friendly, be honoring to the stone as well. It's kind of like the stones are using humans to represent their stone ancestors. Is this weird to use the humans? It kind of messes with their head. So anyways, it's good. It's fine to use the stones. From Carmen, can I think of rituals that would be appropriate for one who's going to prison? Oh, it's not a funny question at all. Is there any death rebirth ritual that might transport well to that context? I don't know how to tie it in a little bit to ancestor. It's not something I've reflected on a ton, but to tie it into ancestor work, the altar that you're going to have in that context, depending on how permissive the settings are, is your body. And so you want practices that rely only on what you have with your body. And so, of course, meditation is like that, but also ancestor practice is saying the bones, the blood, the body, the DNA is sacred. And so your body is your ancestor altar. And so in that sense, the type of ritual that ancestor practice doesn't need a lot of bling. You can have a fancy altar if you like that, but you don't need it per se. And the type of ritual work that I focus on a lot with ancestor practices, repair of harm or unresolved pain in our lineages. And so that's the type of practice that one could work through on their own, provided they had a book or context. Again, I don't know if books are going to be permitted in that context. So, it's interesting question. Let me know if you want more in a personal email, the parameters of the situation. I might be able to respond more. It's hard to respond more because it's so general. The other thing is to help the person to have from the start, a relationship with the spirit of the land where they're at. Even though there's a oppressive, heavy energy there, it can be a source of resilience to know that you can relate directly with the earth, even in a place of incarceration. Thanks for the question. It's good. Another question. In the past years, I have moved forward in the work with ancestors, participated in an ile or a house in a Yoruba traditional religion in Puerto Rico, decided to have an ancestor altar, is taking a course with Yaya Tish, who I met through you. Cheers. The most difficult promise to be consistent. So basic things that help with consistency and honoring them. It's a good question. The two things that come to mind right off, one are make sure that you're relating with only your well and elevated and wise and kind ancestors. Because if you're calling on all of them generally, and your invocations work, which you want them to, then you're going to be calling in a mixed range of energies. And if you're calling in that effectively, then your practice is not going to feel consistently nourishing, and it won't be a motivation to continue. So you want to ask, you can picture your well ones as a group being around you, really set a high bar for wellness. And so the ancient grandmas and grandpas and super well ancestors, and you can ask them to respectfully stand between the ones who are not yet well, between you and the ones who are not yet well. So that's one practice, is to visualize that vision, you know, just visualize them around you. Notice how it feels, cultivate that feeling. The second is to talk to them often. Don't just do it at your ancestor shrine. In that way, a shrine is actually harmful to your relationship with your ancestors if you only relate with them there. It's as if you've compartmentalized them to there. So talk to them, just talk to them as you're going about your day, to the well ones, to the exceptionally well ones, which may or may not include your most recent remembered dead. And so that habit of speaking out loud to the spirits breaks an unconscious agreement of colonialism and disconnection that we tend to be down lineage from culturally. And so talk to them just about your day. Be in a habit of, if you feel guilty that you haven't gone to them, tell them that you feel guilty. If you feel annoyed that you can't connect with them and insecure and lacking, then tell them that. Like, speak true words. Don't worry about being like proper and formal with them. Just be open. So get in the habit of speaking to them and make sure you're calling the bright ones around you is one thing. And then the last thing is learn some songs. If you're doing Yoruba practice, you could learn Lukumi songs. You could also learn traditional Yoruba songs. Check out Asabioje, Asabioje, and Egungun, Egungun on YouTube, and start to learn some songs. Yeah. Thanks, Anna. It's good. Be tenacious also. Don't give up on it. Just lean in hard with them. Yeah. What's a good place to start with ancestral healing if you don't know your blood lineage? It's a big open question. Let me actually circle back to that question and get questions from folks who I haven't responded to yet. How would you suggest people approach the work if they're being tapped by a recently deceased person who's not a family but a peer? It's a good question. I am not personally a big fan of, it sounds rude, but to say indulging the contacts from the dead who are not related by family or blood and who are just showing up, like the more or less respectful, but the needy dead, the ones who are just coming to us with, you know, like the lonely bar ghost that follows us home, or our friend who died and is like, I killed myself. It didn't work. I'm still here. Help, help. And it's understandable from their side, but unless you have chosen to train in how to safely deal with that, it's my encouragement to say, hey, other person who's trained in how to deal with this, I think I have one of those situations. Can I hire you to help with this? And to actually just contract it out. Like, if you had a specialized, we don't have the view that if we have a root canal, we're going to be like, wow, I got to look up how to fix my root canal at home on YouTube. We wouldn't expect that. But there's a tendency with assisting the dead who are not yet well to become ancestors to think that we should just know how to do that. And I don't think it's a fair assumption. If you already know, then ask your helpful powers and ancestors to assist that person. But if you don't know at all, I would encourage reaching out to people who are more in the know and can, you know, possibly take it as a nudge to acquire that framework, but it takes a minute. Now there are ways you can generally help. You can make offerings. You can do some stuff generally. But if they're really quite stuck or quite troubled, then it's going to be one of those more than sage situations, or more than, you know, just offerings. Because offerings alone aren't going to help the dead or not yet well to become well. So it's like fuel, but you don't know which tank to put it in for what intent. So treat it like a real situation. Take it seriously is what I'd also say. Because you might be the only person in their life that could help them. And your willingness to respond might be the difference between decades of confused dreaming in ghost state or not. So do intervene, but contact some people who have training in it. Yeah, good. That's a good question. Okay, here's a big charge question. Is there a ritual to help heal intergenerational PTSD of slavery? I, as a American white guy, so let me speak from my position, I would say that I'm generally aware of a lot of different people, especially, but not only, of African ancestry. I assume we're talking about the transatlantic slave trade, not other ongoing or miserable forms of slavery throughout human history ongoing. So making that assumption, there are a good number of people who are already doing that kind of ritual. Period. Full stop. For me personally, the way I would tend to approach that is to encourage people whose ancestors have experienced those ordeals to, from the start, recruit the involvement of the even older ancestors, the even older grandmothers and grandfathers who lived before that interruption of ancient, beautiful, diverse lineages in often West Africa, and to let those older, intact, well, never enslaved ancestors be a guiding force and principle of protection and healing throughout that process, so that the attempt to constructively engage a very major historical trauma, which doesn't end, of course, with the formal outlawing of slavery. So it's really the intergenerational PTSD of white supremacy ongoing, including slavery. So to have the older healed ancestors oversee the process so that it's not re-traumatizing throughout, and to apply principles of titration or pacing with respect to personal grief, and making sure that the intensity level at which one is engaging is beneficial rather than re-traumatizing or harmful for one's nervous system. And to bring elements of ritual to it and bring elements of community to it, so that it's not a lonely or isolated process. So those are some general principles that I think apply. And so there are many kinds of rituals that are required. And the ongoing ritual, so to speak, is the overhaul of our culture to uproot systemic injustice. So when there's ongoing harm, it makes healing from the past all the more important, and not impossible, but tricky because there's ongoing harm. And so, yeah. Thanks. It's a great question. Those are some general things about it from where I'm sitting. Someone asked, the interested in learning more about ancestral healing as it relates to the body, specifically to the womb. Man. I'm going to answer as a guy again, all these questions. Again, white guy answering question about ancestral healing in the womb. I will answer it to the best of my ability. What I would say, to apply the same principle, you want your older, ancient pre-colonialism, pre-disaster of the last 500 to 2,000 years, the older grandmas to be in on that healing. So in general, you want to make sure that your body, any part of your body, is not a sink or a repository or a focus for the heavy, unhealed energies of the dead who are not yet well. And so making sure that especially the at least two lineages of grandmothers before you, your father's mother and your mother's mother, and the lineage of women before them on back through time to ancient times, that those lineages are deeply healed and well. And once they're deeply healed and well, you can say to them, grandmothers who are now deeply well, can you make sure that my physicality, including my womb, is healed and well also, and a portal for your goodness? And that if, you know, if you're having children or intend to have children, that any new life that would move through you is embodying health and vitality. And so there's so much that could be said, but the most important thing that would be problematic to omit is make sure your actual grandmothers of blood are well in spirit, and that your channel of communication is open with them, and that they're able to teach you directly about how the grandmothers in your specific lineages worked with the mysteries of the womb and birth and creation and dreaming and witchery and all that. So bring them in the conversation. Thank you, Julie. Yeah. Other questions? This is a common question. How do we know if they're well? It's a fine question, and there are layers of nuance with it. In the book, if you have the book, it's all in chapter 5. And but to speak to it generally, how do you know if a living person is well? I would say unless you're really in a bubble where you're not perceiving clearly or have a lot of projection, you're probably going to be accurate 90-95% of the time, especially if you have a couple minutes to tune into a person. You can probably group people into like, oh yeah, they seem well, they seem quite present, or they are definitely not well, or I'm not sure yet. And that's how I invite people to think about the dead on a 1 to 10 scale. So the 1 to 3 are the really funky, troubled, toxic, whether or not they mean to be ghosts. The 7 to 10 range are the deeply well, safe to be around, safe around the kids, awesome ancestors. And the 5 to 4 to 6 in between range are the regular ghosts. Meh, not so great, not toxic, kind of in between. And personally, I don't advocate relating with anyone below a 7 directly, partly because the dead are so boundary diffuse by nature, and because we're so boundary porous and unconscious in this culture, partly because we're not trained to have strong boundaries, partly because we invalidate the reality of the spirits. And those two things in combination mean that we're likely to glom all up in the energy body of the dead who are not yet well. And so I have a really high bar about it. And I'm like, only relate with decisively, clearly, tangibly good energies. So if any of them are not yet in that state, be like, peace, boundary, love you, like I need you anywhere in the universe except for in my body, please. And that's okay. It's okay. It's people sometimes think they're abandoning their ancestors when I'm like, don't let them live in your body. And I'm saying you don't abandon your ancestors, but have a loving boundary with the ghosts, the not yet ancestors, until they become well. So, but how do we know if they're well? You just kind of know. If you tune in and I'm like, is that person well? And you tune in, you're like, oh, they're not well. Or like, oh my God, they're well. They were such a terrible person during life. How did they get well? They seem well. And so you tune in and you usually know. That's a short answer. But I do it in a structured way because it needs to be safe-ish. Great. Should kids have their own ancestor shrine or should they sit at their parents' altar? I'd encourage the sitting at their parents' altar. That's how, unless they're really witchy kids and they really want their own spot, in which case give them clear directives. But I think it's good for the grown-ups to titrate the energy of bigger powers for the kids until their nervous system and consciousness is ready to fully handle it. And then you can sit with them together. And that's how it is. Like, we don't, like in our Orisha shrines, I don't, like, my wife's an initiative, well, yeah. I don't have like a second Oya shrine for me, despite loving Oya. Like, we have a shared ancestor altar. We have shared stuff. And so it's common for just one house to have the ancestor spot. So like that. Good. Okay. The questions are good. I'm going to respectfully skim over. Some people have asked more than one just to bounce around. For someone who's a beginner, what's the essential skills to have at start? Well, the most essential thing is to see with humility that what is called for in this work is reclaiming a framework of what I would consider animism. I know it's a technical, sorry, it's a kitten biting my toes. I know it's a technical term, but the words do matter. The word shamanism is going to cause all your native friends to just wilt away if you already haven't had that happen. Sorry if that's judgy. The word has taken on some baggage. I used to use it and have a lot of dear friends who still use that word. It's fine. But how we talk and think about these things is important. So the word shamanism, or sorry, the word animism just means there's a whole bunch of different kinds of beings. And living humans are just one kind of being. The not incarnate right now, or you could say not living humans, the ancestors are another. And it's going to take a minute, the plants, the animals, deities, etc. And have the humility, not implying you don't, to learn a thing, meaning it's going to take a minute to know what's the etiquette to approach these others. If I'm like, oh, suddenly there's people from 15 different countries that have moved into your neighborhood and you need to be a good neighbor, you'd be like, well, geez, well, what are the Somalis like? Their etiquette might be different than the people from Guatemala, from wherever. And so there's a learning curve, and having that be kind of clunky and experiential and having to read stuff and talk to people and reach out is normal and appropriate. Animism, or the etiquette for relating with the other than humans or the other than incarnate humans, is a learned process, so it's learnable. I tried to write the book in a really beginner, intentionally, not in a bad way. People sometimes are turned off by the phrase beginner, but like a fundamentals way, because I actually believe that relating with the others who are not living humans is a totally normal thing. It doesn't make you spiritual or special, or there's nothing unique about it per se. It's a very common thing. It's something we've culturally lost touch with often. But so I'd say be hopeful about reclaiming a vocabulary and a etiquette for navigating these other relationships. To see it, frame it in that way. It's like you're expanding your relational capacity to learn the contours and the protocol and the etiquette for lots of other kinds of relationships. And give it a focused year of study, and then look up and be like, well, did I learn anything in the last year? And like, is it moving along? So no, it's going to take a minute. I know it's a general answer, but I mean, it's lame to say read the book, but I do cover some of that in the book in terms of having reclaiming a language for it. So feel free to ask a more specific question if there is one, but that's the big zoomed out answer on that. Next question. What would you say about feeling the presence of a spirit during waking life when you're not working with the ancestors, trying to decide whether or not that spirit's simply visiting or if they need and require assistance with elevation? I don't tend for myself to be available to help rogue spirits. That's so, I don't know, maybe that's selfish and ungenerous of me. I don't know. But it's like people need to go through proper channels to get to me. So if I think that's good with spirit work. And if you have, I guess what I would say is if you have someone come to you, a spirit entity, then you can ask your own, call in your own trusted powers, your ancestors, the deities, the ones you work with, and be like, what's that? Like, what do you see over there? Because you're used to the contours of the communication with them more. And so you can ask them, is that something I need to deal with? Or do I just like, boundary up and move about my day? And so let them be the ones to screen those types of interactions. That's my habit. I think people, I don't know, I don't mean to be judgy about it, but I think people sometimes are more available to spontaneous spirit contact than I would tend to be. Now, if it's a ritual for work with spirits of place, and you're in ritual space, and the spirit's like, yo, this is my place, you're doing ritual here, like, come on, then there needs to be flexibility about who's showing up. So it depends on the context a little bit. Yeah. So it's okay to be boundaried, I guess is what I'd say. Somebody's asking about scholarship for the online course. That's fine. There are additional scholarships. Just message me directly and we'll sort it out. Once one opens up to communicating with ancestors, how does one set boundaries for the when and where? It's a good question. And to some degree, you have a choice about that. I don't have a lot of spontaneous spirit contact. If they really need to get a message through, I do remember my dreams. And so it'll show up there. And then I'll bring it to the shrines and be like, all right, what was that? Do I need to listen to that? But maybe it's different for me because I do a lot of ritual in my life. And so they're like, all right, he's doing what we want him to do. So we're not going to pester him. So to some degree, once you get your life really in alignment with your destiny, then you're just busy doing what you're here to do. And then you can say to the spirits like, yo, help me out. I need help with these things. And it's not that there aren't new messages, but to some degree, it's like, yes, there's always interesting visions and all these things you could talk to me about, but what do I really need to do to be a good, like, dad and chef and update my blog or whatever your thing is in your life? And so the communication can almost narrow into a very pragmatic mode over time. Once the ancestors are well, once you're on point with your life, and then you have occasional celebrations and big visionary things, or you go eat mushrooms in the woods and it's all clear. And then you come back and then you're just like, all right, what do I need to do my next blog post about? So, I don't tend to be so open to contact whenever. And if they're really pressing me, I'll be like, all right, I'm going to make coffee. I'll be at the shrine in a half an hour. We'll sit down. I'll tune in. So you create openings for them to communicate with you. It's like it depressurizes the relationship. So they don't have to like be dramatic to get your attention. Yeah. But be a little, you know, be bossy with that. Yeah. Thanks. That's a good question, Arturo. Yeah. I love all the questions. I'm going to try to get to all of them. It's enjoyable. Thanks, everybody. How does a person who's currently willfully estranged from living relatives because their shits begin getting started with ancestral healing? Yeah, you just exclude the living totally, is what you do, because they are not required to connect with the ancestors of blood who you can go to directly. And sometimes, like if you have a restraining order out against your parents because they're awful, the ancestors will probably be like, that's a great restraining order. May it be strengthened. And if there's an opening that you hadn't seen for healing, they'll probably gently over time nudge you toward those openings. But the ancestors, the well ancestors, have a much bigger view than the recent family. And they are totally understanding in my experience about when we need a boundary with living family. And even when it's like a soft boundary, when they're like, God, your family's annoying. We understand. We're sorry they got like that. Here's how they got like that. Look at the history. Look what was happening in the 1800s. Can you blame them? And so they'll want you to have kindness toward them, but also they're cool. So don't let it be an obstacle at all. You just go around them. It doesn't have to go through them. So just go around them. Yep. Similar question, how do you navigate when someone has adverse feelings toward their ancestors? It's a great question. As a just super culturally privileged white guy, it would be so easy for me to be like, my ancestors are white supremacists, colonizer, homophobic, loser, terrible, etc., etc. I mean, they're the timeline of history, I suppose, could be even worse, but however, like it's pretty bad as a American white guy. And take on all the blame. Just take on all the burden. Let me clarify, because that seems like an unhelpfully provocative thing to say. What I mean to say, for one, is that we're expand your picture of the ancestors to include the ancient ones, the much older ones. So even if your ancestors were slave owning terrible people in the last four centuries, they probably weren't terrible people before the expansion of the Roman Empire. They probably, I mean, they might have been annoying in their community, but they probably also were earth honoring, ritually interesting people that would fit your cultural sensibilities for what's positive that I'm assuming that you bring into the table. So let those ones be the ones that primarily define your sense of ancestors, and the more ancient grandmas and grandpas in eclipse or embrace and essentially reform the ones who live between us and them. Because remember, the dead change, and your ancestors who were harmful during life have continued to exist for the last 100, 200, 300 years. And it's possible they changed. So as odd as it sounds, I'm kind of going with the threat of race here, but they could be shits for a lot of other reasons, but let's assume it's because of that. Your slave owning terrible during life ancestors in death, once they go through a transformative process, can actually become strong spiritual supporters for embodying anti-racist advocacy and relating and life in the present. So the dead change. They can even culturally change. The ancestors are dwell in the present. They're not just memories. So it's important to not freeze them in time. So even though it seems like a noxious or difficult endeavor to embrace one's ancestors when you come from a background of carrying out historical oppression, it's actually an excellent place to have leverage over all of it and to ensure that there are not troubled dead being reborn, and to make sure your own ancestors are vibrant and excellent and like down on the for the right side of history at this point. It's good for them. They'll thank you for it, and you'll feel better in your body, because otherwise you end up with to hate our ancestors is to hate our body. And so it's a illness encouraging stance, unfortunately. Yeah. Any wisdom about an ancestor's war wound manifested as injury, illness in a descendant? Any specific ancestral trouble that's showing up in the body of someone who's alive in the present? The first thing that needs to happen is to make sure the one whose pattern seems to be repeating is themselves ancestralized. They need to be well. They need to be healed in spirit, which almost always, if they're not already healed, they're probably not if that's happening, entails going farther back in time. And because their wound that you are conceptualizing as the start of the problem could be the repeating of a much older problem. My grandpa's suicide was like that. He was caught in a generationally repeating problem that started long ago and needed to be worked at a much older root. So yeah, you need to go back to the ancient ones along that specific lineage to be like, all right, where does this start? How do I resolve it? How do I not play it out now? So good. Yeah, thanks. That's a good question. What if my ancestors, who are not well in spirit, are pissed because I'm trying to heal them up? Well, too bad. You go back to the even older ones. Seriously, you go around them. Or you don't like, all right, let me try to be more respectful and deliberate about how I respond. The process that I encourage entails going to the ancient ones first. And you're saying to these ancient ones, yo, there's a problem in the lineage. Things are a mess down here. Please intervene. I respectfully, as your blood descendant, request your intervention for the healing of the lineage between you and I. And the old ones can hardly resist that kind of respectful and relevant appeal. So then the work begins. And what's important is that the lineage is repaired or healed up from the ancient times toward the present. And so the ones who are not well in spirit, you're not engaging them, right? Let's say it's the last 10 generations and they're just like, we are in a trance of hatred and we love it and we're just going to keep hating. Like, okay, great. And so you go and make sure the lineage is healed from the ancient times to 11 generations back. And then you ask all the ones that are in their stuck, whatever, stance, to be surrounded by the collective well energy of the ancient and now more recent ones that are healed. And it becomes like a siege of positivity. And it's kind of like, okay, well, your ancient, loving, forgiving grandfathers are here just watching you pitch a fit and just want to notice that you're doubling down on your stuck stance. So at that point, most of them will be like, some will start to defect. And then once that happens, the whole resistance crumbles, usually. So go to the older ones directly. Just bypass the grouchy stuck ones. Yep. Other questions? It's great. I love the questions. Is there a generalized view that the ancestors have toward the living? Can we prepare ourselves as we're alive to be well, to enter the spirit world? These are big questions. I don't know that there's a generalized view that the ancestors have toward the living, besides sure would be nice to be in relationship. Sure would be nice to not have to just watch you replay all of our problems that we could totally help with if you would only tune in, because we have this massive intergenerational labyrinth of wisdom and love and kindness and perspective that you totally need that you're not drawing on, and sure would be nice to be in relationship. And so I think that's how the ancestors of a lot of Western people who aren't tuning in might feel. Some of them, I know I'm in a snarky mood, but the others are like, we love you, we want you to be happy, we want you to live your destiny, like all the good things, all the good things. But their support of us is easier when we allow for it to happen consciously. But they have a lot of kindness, but also the ancestors are masters at the human experience. That's their specialization. So they have a lot of beauty and artistry and humanity and love, like really complex layered human love. Not like ancient, like the way the stars love the planets kind of love, more like the way people, humans love other humans love. So they have great perspective and wisdom and love and humility. They want to share it. So I would say that. And to the way we prepare to be an ancestor mostly is to be ethical and to be good to people, even if it's unpopular, even if it's hard and it means we miss out on things, be ethical, because it prepares us for when we drop our body and maybe forget our name and we can't intellectualize our way through what happens after the body is gone. So you have to rely on instinct that reaches deeper than just superficial identity. And if you have a lifetime of relating from a stance of interdependence, also known as being ethical, then your instincts are going to serve you well in the post-death journey. So aside from all the ritual fancy things, which can also help, and going to therapy and working your stuff out, being ethical, that's the main thing. Yeah. Asking about the approach of mother's mother's line, father's father's line. It's my habit in the work. My habit is to approach the relationship with blood ancestors from a lineage framework. And I see it as an intermediate setting, meaning it's not all the ancestors are one collective. You can relate with them in that way, but it's quite intense, and it's like stepping into a storm of many complex different energies. And the other end of the spectrum is relating with individual souls and spirits, which I actually don't tend to do that much. Although it's totally possible. So in between those two are lineages, bloodlines, currents, specific groups, groups within the collective. And that can be based on bloodline, or it can be based on all the ancestors of a certain vocation or who are devotees of a certain deity. And when working with it on a bloodline approach, I'm also implicitly encouraging people to see themselves as the as a participant in a lineage, and that we're made of a collective kind of energy, and that our in what we think of as our individuality is includes like a dipper full from a bigger system. And I encourage people to look at four lineages, what I consider their four primary lineages. So think of your four biological grandparents and the lineage of women in particular before your grandmothers on back through time, and the lineage of men before your grandfathers on back through time. Of course, we have 8, 16 lineages, etc., but really considering those four creates a foundation for the work. And for folks who it's helpful to hear this, when I say lineage of men, lineage of women, I'm back through time, I'm not assuming anything about the sexual orientation or gender identity of these ancestors, only that they conceived and that you're genetically related to them. And so, yeah, let me leave it at that. So it's a lineage-based approach. I think it's good for our tendency to be very individualistic in the West. We have just a few minutes if anybody has other questions. And what else about that? Yeah, Western ancestor practice tends to strongly emphasize individuals and the recent dead. And I'm saying lineages, and not only the recent dead, also the older ones. So, yeah, consider that. If anyone typed a question before, I'm not going to scroll up for it right now. So sorry if I missed it. Let me say that, because we'll finish pretty soon. If the online course, I know I mentioned it before, but for context, I've been teaching this work. It's like my full-time thing for about 12, 13 years. And the book just came out this year, which took me 9 years to write it, but it's quite thorough and it's very practice-oriented. So I'm hopeful that it's useful to people. And it's directly sharing through exercises the work that's been a part of the sessions and the three-day trainings since 2005. And the online course, and I'll put the link up again here, is also thorough and has 14 lessons. And it's each one is over a half an hour of instruction through good quality video. So over 7 hours of content. There's different articles for each of the 14 lessons, excerpts from the book, but also different readings from different people in different cultures on ancestor reverence and opportunity to interact with other people in the course. And there's a really diverse group of people, not just from North America. There's also Australians and a couple Australian Aboriginal people and European folks and just people from different areas. So it brings a richness to the dialogue that's possible and opportunity to ask questions throughout. So, and scholarship for folks who are Indigenous, African ancestored, LGBTQ, etc. So reach out if that is supportive to you, and be hopeful that even if you don't have a background in ritual, even if some of this seems esoteric, even if you think your ancestors suck and are just full of disappointment, that you can have a really lively, personal, relevant, empowering connection with your blood ancestors. There's magic and goodness and blessing that they would love to bring to your awareness. So, yeah, let me say that. I'm going to stop recording. If people need more information, check out ancestralmedicine.org.